participation in this call is by express written invitation of the AHA only. Unauthorized participants and or any party that aids and abets such unauthorized participants may be subject to criminal and civil penalties under both state and federal law, including the Electronic Communication Privacy Act. Good day and welcome to the American Hospital Association, OHSU. Our community response to the opioid epidemic, hospitals and health systems impacting the opioid crisis conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. However, the Q&A session at the end of the conference will not be recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Alisa. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Alisa Adespacochero, Senior Director with AHA's Physician Leadership Forum. And on behalf of my colleague, Rebecca Chickey, who leads the AHA's section for psychiatric and substance abuse services, thanks for joining us on today's webinar featuring Oregon Health and Science University. To present today's session, we're pleased to have with us Dr. Tom Yackel, Clinical Integration Officer, OHSU Partners, and Associate Dean for Clinical Affairs at Oregon Health and Science University, and a member of AHA's Committee on Clinical Leadership. He leads the clinical and business transformation to value-based care with OHSU's faculty and strategic partner and serves as chair of the Quality Health Management Committee and on the board of directors for the Population Health Alliance of Oregon. Also joining us is Dr. Melissa Weimer, assistant professor in the Division of Internal Medicine at OHSU, associate program director of the OHSU Addiction Medicine Fellowship, and the medical director at CODA, Oregon's largest nonprofit substance abuse treatment center. She's an expert in the safe and effective use of opioids for the treatment of pain, as well as treating opioid use disorders in primary care and special addictions care. Today's call will focus on the three-county collaborative involving 14 hospitals from four health systems, two community care organizations, and four health departments that have developed a community standard to reduce the use of and addiction to opiates. With that, let me turn it over to Tom.
Thanks very much, Alisa. I appreciate that introduction. And good afternoon, everybody. I'm very pleased to be introducing this presentation on how our community has responded to the opioid epidemic. Before we get to Dr. Weimer, our main speaker, I wanted to take a few minutes to set the stage for today's presentation. First, we begin at the beginning, and that is with the recognition that we are dealing with a crisis that we as healthcare providers created. In a well-intentioned attempt to improve the treatment of pain, providers used the tools available to them at the time, namely prescription opioids. Unfortunately, we now know that particular way of addressing the situation faced by our patients with chronic pain has unintended consequences, such as those that you see here. While it's often true that change can be stimulated from the top, I'm a firm believer that local action is always required, especially when it comes to engaging providers to change their clinical behavior. But physicians and individual practices can't go this one alone. The opioid epidemic is a problem affecting our communities, and a community solution is required. In our circumstance in Portland, Oregon, our community came together around our health needs assessment. Out of that planning effort, our work on addressing the opioid epidemic was born. This quote from President Barack Obama reminds us that the impact of the opioid crisis on our patients and their families is significant. With that, I'm very excited to turn this talk over to our main speaker, Dr. Melissa Weimer, who will share with you our community's efforts to address this problem.
Thanks so much, Dr. Yackel. I'm going to bring my slides up here. Okay. So I want to basically talk about three different things today. First, I want to describe the collaborative approach that our community came to develop a community standard for opioid prescribing. I want to describe how health systems have, or our health system in particular, has changed to make improvements to how we treat opioid use disorder. And then I want to describe some opportunities that I see for health systems to make similar improvements. I think it's important to understand the epidemic and how we're seeing, how do we know that this is occurring? Many of you may have seen slides such as this, but they're all unfortunately increasing over time. So we've seen since the 1990s that we're not only seeing increases due to opioid overdose deaths, but we're also seeing increases in treatment admissions due to opioid use disorder, and these are generally due to opioid pain relievers specifically, not heroin. These have all of these associations and trends have paralleled an increase that we have seen in opioid sales, i.e. prescription opioid use. And then I forgot to mention there, as you can see on the bottom, unfortunately, we're also seeing problems due to neonatal abstinence syndrome within our hospitals due to opioid use for pregnant women. So all of these associations and trends are occurring at the same time, and as you can see, very worrisome increases there. So some people might say, well, how do we know that these are opioid analgesic? This is a problem of opioid analgesics and not of heroin. Well, actually both are occurring. Opioid analgesic use has certainly increased and has steadily continues to increase. But heroin really stayed pretty flat for a while until about 2010 we started to see some increases of heroin use. There's been concern that as we have, quote, you know, cracked down on opioid prescribing, that maybe we're shifting people to heroin, and that's somewhat of a debated topic. We actually think that the increases we're seeing in heroin use and overdose may be related more to increased production of heroin and increased purity of some of the heroin that's coming into our country. So we can't say for sure that there's a specific correlation between tightening standards of opioid prescribing and increased heroin use. This slide just shows graphically how we can see changes over time. And I wanted to show a comparison of treatment admissions for heroin use compared to prescription use. And as you can see in this slide, basically from, 2002 to 2012, we see pretty steady admissions for heroin. We're not seeing a lot of increases there compared to how non-heroin opioid treatment admissions have increased over time. You can clearly see that what was occurring in 2002 has only grown dramatically over the last 10 years, the last data from 2012. And I suspect if we showed data from 2016, we would see a mostly red, unfortunate country. Similarly, if we look at trends over time of drug overdoses or opioid overdoses, this nice graphic comes from the New York Times back in January, showing how drug overdoses due to opioids have changed over time, and we really clearly have one of the worst public health crises now due to opioids. Similarly, compared to other countries, we're not doing very well for just all-cause mortality in general. We're seeing from this nice study that was presented at the National Academy of Science that last year that all-cause mortality for people in the age group of 45 to 54, and these are non-Hispanic U.S. White people, has increased, while in other countries it has decreased. And if we weren't sure exactly why, this graphic helps us understand that the leading cause or the thing that appears to be spurring that mortality are poisonings. And when we compare drug poisonings, if we break that out by substances, it's very clear that opioids are driving the mortality and poisonings that we're seeing in this age group. So this is not a problem of one demographic. This is now a far-reaching problem in all demographics in the United States, and now very clearly affecting mortality in white non-Hispanics as well. So what can you do, given the situation that we all understand is out of control? Well, I think there are three things that we can do. We need to prevent new cases of opioid addiction or opioid use disorder. We need to reduce the supply of pills, either going to pill mills or black markets or in patients' hands. And we need to treat people who have developed a problem due to either prescription opioid use disorder or heroin use. So I'm going to talk about how we as health systems and communities can do some of this work. So in the Portland metro area, we developed something called the Healthy Columbia Willamette Collaborative, and it was really in response to the Affordable Care Act and the public health accreditation mandates for doing community health assessments. And based on this work and through this collaborative, we the collaborative conducted a comprehensive study of the communities in a four-county region, including Washington, Multnomah, Clackamas, and Clark counties, which is actually in Washington. And there were four community health needs that rose to the surface. There was veteran suicide, opioid misuse, breastfeeding, tobacco use, and access to treatment. And from those community health needs, there were two that the community was most concerned about, and that ended up being opioid misuse and breastfeeding. And based on that community health need, we developed some regional strategies to try to address that and brought people together. As I said, the requirements that we were responding to for this community health need were really the Affordable Care Act, requiring a community health needs assessment to be done every 3 years, our public health accreditation, and then this was all also along with the changes with the ACA and the Coordinated Care Organization legislation in Oregon. So these were the members of our collaborative. So this is made of 15 hospitals, four public health departments, and two CCOs. And you may recognize some of the names there. So we had very good engagement and cooperation among these members. And I served as the chair of the opioid misuse work group to create a community standard along with Multnomah County Public Health Officer Paul Lewis. And the prevention strategies that we employed, we wanted to get adoption by all of the member organizations of an opioid prescribing community standard. And we elected to call this a community standard rather than a guideline because we really wanted to elevate the importance that this was now something that our community had agreed was standard practice, standard of care. So we elected to call this a community standard for chronic non-cancer related pain. We did not want to restrict opioid prescribing for patients with terminal conditions or in palliative care. We were very much focused on where we saw the main risks occurring in the population with chronic non-cancer pain. And we wanted this guideline to be implemented by all of our Healthy Columbia Willamette Collaborative members and develop some implementation strategies as well as provider and patient education. Our goal was that the community standard would be adopted by all member organizations by 2016, and our outcome that we were hoping for is that we would see reduced rates of opioid-related deaths in our region. Um, we decided to, as I said, create this community standard that was specifically for patients who had chronic non-cancer, non-terminal pain, and we very much felt that it needed to be a simple document. It needed to have kind of simple guiding principles and that could easily be interpreted and implemented. So we were very very clear about wanting this to, say, fit on one piece of paper, something that people could refer to very easily. We had several conversations about, you know, do we get very specific about establishing a dosing guideline, and we elected to establish a dosing guideline. Our dosing guideline did occur prior to CDC guidelines that recently came out establishing a dosing guideline, so you'll see in the next slide here our community standard for patients who are newly prescribed opioid prescriptions, and you'll see that our dosing guideline, our dose limit is 120 milligrams of morphine equivalents in 24 hours, and I suspect that we will likely revise that in keeping with CDC guidelines to 90 milligrams of morphine equivalents in the future. But as you can see here, we have these 10 guiding principles, and really these are no different than what you're seeing in the CDC guidelines and really kind of help establish what should a provider do for a patient who is coming in and they're considering to start an opioid prescription for chronic non-cancer pain. And these, many of these guiding principles are things that you would do for any patient that you're evaluating. Of course, you're going to perform an evaluation in history. You are going to, you know, document their initial and periodic functional evaluations. But, you know, all of these things, again, are kind of self-explanatory, but we felt that it was important to delineate some of these so that patients were not just focusing on opioids, that they were focusing on functional improvements, they were focusing on good care as well. We did have a lot of emphasis here on screening for opioid risk. So what are the risks of patients developing a problem with opioids? We focused on developing a comprehensive treatment plan, as you can see in Guiding Principle 6, with agreed-upon treatment goals prior to beginning treatment. We recommended behavioral health evaluation for patients who had current or prior behavioral health conditions. We did delineate some, as you see in Guiding Principle 8, some high-risk medications or substances that should be avoided, specifically benzodiazepines, which are very dangerous when concomitantly prescribed with opioids. We could not come to consensus about marijuana. As you may know, marijuana is legal in the state of Oregon, and there were several issues such as marijuana where we couldn't necessarily find consensus. And when we did have issues such as that, we did give leeway to the individual institutions to develop their own policies or guidelines around that use. We very much wanted to emphasize in Guiding Principle 9 that patients who have developed an opioid use disorder during treatment really do need to be referred for treatment and get appropriate care because we were seeing that several times those patients were not necessarily referred or getting access to those treatments. And then Guiding Principles 10, you can see that very much an emphasis on making sure that we are prescribing naloxone in cases where patients are very high risk for a potential overdose. The next slide are our guiding principles, our community standard for patients who are prescribed ongoing opioid prescriptions for chronic non-cancer pain. And there's really not a lot of difference between this guideline and the other guideline other than some of the issues around if a patient is already prescribed high daily dose, what do you do? And we had a lot of, as you see in Guiding Principle 5, and we had a lot of discussion about this, what should practices do in the case of a patient who's on high-dose opioids. And what we decided was that there may be cases where a provider feels that a high dose of an opioid is indicated, but we didn't want the provider to make that decision alone, and we really felt that the provider should be getting a secondary review, because in many cases patients may benefit from a secondary review, number one, and they may benefit from a lower dose of an opioid, and we need to support them and get a second set of eyes to help make that decision. So that's the main difference that you would see here. And just some changes in language. And again, part of that was just to make sure we were clear about you know, new versus ongoing prevention of starting people on opioids versus how do you deal with patients who are already prescribed opioids. Some data that came out of one of our own clinics, the OHSU Internal Medicine Clinic, just to describe, you know, do these community standards actually work, or do these guidelines work? Because we don't actually have a lot of data to show that they reduce opioid prescriptions. But as you can see in this graphic, in this particular clinic where there were about 500 patients prescribed chronic opioid therapy, when you look at the red bars are the patients who are prescribed high-dose opioids, and this would be someone who's prescribed over 120 milligrams of morphine equivalents versus the patients who are not prescribed high-dose. You'll see that the average high-dose opioid prescription was about 200 milligrams of morphine equivalents, and over time, if you look kind of at the middle of those graphics, you'll see that when the opioid standard was put into place, which was after pre-2 time period, you see that there are reductions in the opioid doses, such that the average opioid dose, the median opioid dose goes from 200 to about 140 or so. Now, granted, that wasn't our goal. Our goal was less than 120, and I think that says, you know, emphasizes that this takes time. They're not necessarily going to be, you're not going to get everyone off of high-dose opioids to the lower standard immediately, but we are seeing dramatic and significant reductions, which are really important. So this does appear to work, and granted, this is only one clinic, but within this one clinic, we were able to see some significant changes. And then in Washington State, which has actually legislated opioid dosing limits, we're seeing a really significant outcome, which is work done by Gary Franklin, showing that in the workers' comp population, when they started implementing opioid dosing guidelines, they're seeing reductions in opioid-related deaths. So this is really important data that they've continued to show improvements in reductions in opioid-related deaths after we've established opioid dosing guidelines, which is really one of the most important goals or outcomes that we're looking for. So some of the implementation strategies that we utilized at OHSU, which was a part of the Healthy Columbia Willamette Collaborative and was agreeing to these community standards, was to really identify and support key leadership within our institution. So we needed to have, you know, pain champions who could help move this work along, because it's not necessarily easy work to do. So we worked with our Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee to establish a health system policy which would support the community standards. So this was agreement among physician and provider leaders within our health system to support this work and commit to following this community standard. In addition to that, it's very important that we are developing electronic medical record tools to help not only monitor the use of opioids, but also report back to providers and provide data about both dose as well as dangerous concomitant use, such as use of benzodiazepines and opioids. And we are currently in the process of developing those tools to push data to providers so that they can see on a regular basis that, you know, sort of where they sit within their prescribing patterns. I think it goes without saying, but patient and provider education is a huge, huge step in this work, and we're still trying to figure out how do we best do that for providers and patients. Regionally, there is a lot of work to develop videos for patients to help describe the epidemic and how, why this is an important issue. And for providers, regionally, there have been a lot of very specific CME days that have gone on to help providers establish the tools and education to do this work. And then finally, we needed referral resources for not only pain treatment, but also if a patient were to develop an opioid use disorder, what referral resources are there. So we have been collecting in an outpatient setting and in an inpatient setting, trying to establish those resources and get that information out to everyone. Some of the outcomes that we think may come out of this work, particularly in the outpatient setting, we think that we will probably see decreased healthcare utilization for patients. So if they're not having as many harms due to their prescriptions or they're not utilizing the emergency department as much, we think there'll be a lot better improved staff communication and decreased non-productive staff time. There is a lot of time that goes into helping patients understand these guidelines once they're put in place, and just the time that your initial, you know, phone staff are answering the phone for a potentially angry patient or dealing with, you know, a prescription of some kind or another. These are all time that is lost from providing other types of care. We do think that this will lead to improved pain treatment, so that we'll see patients having improved functional status as opposed to, you know, only focusing on pain improvements. And we also think that with dose reductions and limits, we will see decreased opioid pills in circulation. From an outcomes standpoint for patients, we hope that we will see decreased opioid overdose morbidity and mortality, decreased diversion, and hopefully decreased opioid use disorder or addiction. We think that all of these things will improve staff and provider job satisfaction, and we do recognize that temporarily we may see decreased patient satisfaction as patients sort of themselves grapple with this change in care, that we may see that, and we're somewhat prepared to deal with that, but also have to come to agreement that we may see that. So in this three-pronged approach, as we're both trying to prevent new cases of opioid use disorder and reduce supply, it's also, as I said, very important that we're treating patients who may have already developed an opioid use disorder. So in the next set of slides, I'm going to talk about how we've designed some programming to help inpatients with opioid use disorder. So with the direction of Anora Englander, who is one of our phenomenal clinical integration specialists here at OHSU, we performed a inpatient needs assessment of patients who are in the hospital for any reason. And we did this of 185 hospitalized patients. And for those patients who had substance use disorders, we saw that about 57% of them had high-risk alcohol use, and then 68% of them, that's incorrect. Many of them had substance use disorders, and of those who had substance use disorders, 57% and 68% of them reported wanting to cut back or quit. To date, we did not, or when we were doing this needs assessment, we did not have a concerted way to necessarily help them other than having social workers in the hospital provide them with community resources. Many of the patients that we were speaking to really wanted help with medication-assisted treatment, and they wanted that started in the hospital, and they wanted to have direct bridges to community access. So we saw that there was a huge need during hospitalization, and it was potentially, as we've called it, reachable moment where we could start some very key treatments and bridge people to care. As many of you know, the gap time to community substance use disorder treatment can be quite long. Generally, wait times are in the order of magnitude of weeks to months. And that doesn't really work for someone who's coming into the hospital with high, you know, medical morbidity, and they really need access to rapid treatment. So is there something we can do to help facilitate that? Finally, during this needs assessment, we understood or came to understand that patients really valued choice, and they really wanted to feel that their providers understood what substance use disorder, what that entailed, and how to best treat them. So there was a lot of potential for intervention. We also looked at the cost of readmissions for patients with substance use disorder, and we saw over a period of 4.5 months that among 165 patients with substance use disorder, there were 137 readmissions over that time period, and charges for readmission were quite high. We were seeing an average charge of about $55,000 for patients who had endocarditis, and then $68,000 for patients with osteomyelitis. So quite expensive, and unfortunately, many of these patients were not only getting expensive care, but they were coming in and out of the hospital. We also looked at length of stay for their inpatient stay, and as you can see here in this figure, the x-axis is the days in the hospital, and the y-axis is the expected length of stay, and the line going through there is the line of identity, seeing what you would expect the length of stay to be. And you can see for patients who have endocarditis or osteomyelitis that lengths of stays are much longer than expected, and really getting to be upwards of 50 days and longer. So not only seeing high costs of readmissions, but very long lengths of stays, and many patients wanting treatment and treatment options, but prior to any sort of intervention, we really didn't have a way to address that. So from our needs assessment, with the amazing work of Dr. Nora Englander, we worked to engage some very key community stakeholders who are listed here. And we convened a group of community leaders, and we had three group meetings with lots of small meetings to establish this intervention that I'm going to describe. And we really mapped out what were the patient and system needs for an intervention, and then developed a business case that we presented to hospital administration. And from our needs assessment, we developed what we've called the impact team or the improving addiction care team. So from the need of hospitalization as a reachable moment, knowing that patients want and value choice and they want medication-assisted treatment, and then engagement and trust is key, we established an inpatient consult service that is made up of a addiction medicine-trained physician, a nurse practitioner or PA, a social worker, and a peer recovery mentor who are able to address the treatment needs of patients and rapidly start medication-assisted treatment for patients. And then because there was no usual pathways to outpatient addiction treatment and wait times were long, we established what we've called in-reach liaisons from our two key community partners, Central City Concern and CODA, to create rapid access pathways for substance use disorder treatment. So we're able to not only start the medication in the hospital, but then we're able to continue it and continue treatments that are started in the hospital directly to the community. Finally, because I mentioned the data about patients who have endocarditis and osteomyelitis, we were seeing that those patients in particular had very long lengths of stays, and to date, there really was not a great way to treat them other than potentially keeping them in the hospital or transitioning them to a skilled nursing facility where many times they were not having good outcomes. They were potentially relapsing on drug use or they were getting readmitted. Unfortunately, residential addiction treatment centers typically are not equipped to provide complex medical needs to patients or IV antibiotics. So we developed what we've called the Medically Enhanced Residential Treatment Program, where we actually bring IV antibiotics into a residential treatment setting with the partnership of Coram, which is an infusion specialty pharmacy, and CODA, which has a residential treatment program to offer ongoing both addictions treatment as well as IV antibiotics in a residential addiction treatment program. Preliminary results, which should not be shared, but our results to date from a year of doing this work. We have been referred patients from three services. So we focused on general medicine, family medicine, and then patients who need long-term IV antibiotics. So these patients could be on orthopedics or cardiology or another type of service like that. We've been referred 237 discrete patients. We have worked with about 92% of those patients, 218 of those patients. Of that 218 patients, we have been able to have meaningful engagement with 193 of those patients, and we have started medication-assisted treatment for 124 of those patients, and we have connected 131 of those patients to community addictions treatment. And again, that connection has been a seamless, direct transition rather than a long wait time. So in summary, and we'll have plenty of time for questions, I've presented here community standards for opioid prescribing, those are one way that we can address the opioid epidemic. Believe that access and awareness of treatment for opioid use disorder are essential for us being able to prevent serious harms from the opioid epidemic. And health system support of these changes is essential to provide some of these key interventions, such as the one that I just presented called Impact. And I should mention what I failed to mention, and I should have very clearly mentioned, is that funding for IMPACT was provided by OHSU Hospital, who's been tremendously supportive of this work, and Dr. Yackel has really helped with that, as well as CARE Oregon as our Medicaid payer, providing some assistance there in funding. So thank you very much for listening, and I'd be happy to take any questions, and I'm sure Dr. Yackel would be happy to take any questions that you might have.